This podcast is for general education, information, and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be used as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policies or positions of any entity. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of BCR Pod. I'm Michael Fishman.
And I'm Jamie Lim. We are both senior residents in the BCRP and your hosts for this podcast.
We're going to be taking the next 15 minutes to review a few of the case-based residency conferences from the past week, a few tilts or things I learned today from our clinical shifts, and then highlight co-residents doing cool stuff towards the end.
And with that, let's get started. Starting off with Tuesday's morning conference, because Monday was President's Day and we didn't have any conferences then. Dr. Colleen Kelly, one of our chief residents, had a nursery-focused morning conference where she went through a bunch of different visuals and pictures of things that she's been called to see and take a look at in the nursery and to review whether or not it was concerning or not concerning. Obviously, this is an audio medium, so we don't have any of the pictures to show you today. But just to run through some of the not concerning diagnoses first, we went through pictures of erythema toxicum, pustular melanosis, some physiologic peeling, nevus simplexes, sucking blisters that I learned can actually occur while the baby's in the womb, natal teeth, Epstein pearls, and Bones nodules, which are both keratin filled cysts, as well as ear pits, although you have to make sure that the baby passes their hearing test, are all kind of in the not concerning bucket. We also went through a couple visuals of concerning diagnoses, including ichthyosis, a port wine stain, a cafe au lait spot, especially if there are six or more or greater than half a centimeter, congenital cataracts, congenital glaucoma, as well as umphalitis, especially when compared to normal umbilical irritation.
I can picture all those things in my mind. Yeah. You did such a good job of saying them. It makes sense.
Yeah, just picture it. It's not that hard.
On Wednesday, Dr. Wenren gave us a wonderful lecture about a child with a recent elbow fracture that was casted, but presenting now with left knee pain. And so gave a really good framework, I think, to approach acute unilateral knee pain, especially with possible associated fever. And my big takeaways were having a standardized approach to this kind of joint pain plus fever, and the buckets that she broke it into were MSK. So just thinking like intra and extra articular kinds of injuries, as well as any trauma history, the infectious bucket, obviously with fever as well. So all the things we think about in terms of septic arthritis, osteomyelitis, even transient synovitis as kind of a post-infectious complication, the rheumatologic bucket as well, and then other for more rare kinds of causes. This case actually ended up being pretty interesting in that it was a presentation of IgA vasculitis, or as we more commonly think of it as HSP. This patient ended up developing kind of petechiae that then coalesced in their distal upper and lower extremities, and did a lot of good teaching on HSP diagnostic criteria, which is what we generally think about as palpable purpura, abdominal pain, and then like gold standard diagnostic is a biopsy with IgA deposition, though not required, arthritis, arthralgia, and then renal involvement, which can often present later and is why you get your analysis up to 6 months after their initial presentation. And just a reminder, as always, I think I classically think of HSP as this like thigh, buttock area, palpable purpura, but petechiae can present in all gravity dependent areas that include feet and hands, and the rash may be itchy rather than painful. And just one other pearl that I took away was from a management standpoint that it's almost all supportive NSAIDs for pain. Steroids are actually also for pain. They don't shorten the course of disease. But if you have severe kidney disease, some people think about pulse dose steroids or other immunosuppressants.
Wednesday's noon conference was by our very own Dr. Quinn Cook. It was a case about a two-month-old with hematochezia. The diagnosis in this case was food protein-induced allergic proctocolitis, otherwise known as FPIAP, which is also known as milk protein allergy or milk protein intolerance, sensitivity, eosinophilic proctocolitis, as well as allergic enteritis. These babies are usually otherwise healthy, and I learned that these types of allergic proctocolitis is actually not IgE-mediated, so along with it, you do not get urticaria or skin symptoms. This can occur with breast and formula-fed infants, although the prevalence seems to maybe be slightly more common in breastfed infants. FPIAP triggers include milk, which is the most common, but it also includes egg, soy, and corn. And then for those with FPIAP that's triggered by milk, the use of hydrolyzed formulas is the kind of first line treatment, which includes broken down casein and whey, which can help these symptoms. Maternal elimination diets are also recommended. The one pearl that I learned from this is to really think about how these diets place the mothers at risk for calcium and protein deficiencies, especially if these breastfeeding mothers are already on a vegetarian or vegan diet to begin with. The other thing that I learned is that FPIAP usually resolves around 1 year of age. And to test this, allergists sometimes recommend a slow reintroduction with baked milk, which has like slightly broken down casein and whey proteins. And then Friday morning, we had an amazing EKG tutorial and review by our very own Dr. Victoria Bradford. She first reviewed the standard methodology to reading EKGs, which includes checking the standard, checking the rate, checking the rhythm, checking the axis, taking a look at the intervals, and then really thinking about the EKG morphologies. She went over more than I'm going to be able to kind of describe, especially again, since EKGs are very visual and this is not a visual medium. But the takeaways that I learned was that AVNRT, or atrial ventricular nodal reentrant tachycardia, is when the reentrant pathway is at the level of the AV node, which causes an early retrograde P wave, whereas AVRT, so that's without the N, or atrioventricular reentrant tachycardia, is when there's an accessory pathway at a different area. And so this causes a later retrograde P wave because it's farther away from the node. I also learned that U waves are small deflections immediately following the T wave, and this usually represents prolonged repolarization. So important to think about that if you see a U wave after the T. And then I also learned that a good way of really measuring the height or depression of a ST segment is to take a look at the ST to T wave segment ratio, which is the amplitude of the ST. So that's measuring it from the PR to the J point, measured against the amplitude of the T wave. Some other final pearls were that for TCA overdoses, which can commonly cause QRS prolongation, a QRS of greater than 100 is an indication for treatment with sodium bicarb. And then finally, we went over some criteria for LVH, which I can never remember. Learned that for the diagnosis of LVH, you must have voltage criteria as well as meet criteria for some sort of non-voltage criteria.
Fun fact, the TCA overdose study was done by Fred Lovejoy, who literally drove around the hospitals in Massachusetts every time there was a TCA overdose and measured them all by hand. And now we know.
And now onto our tilts of the week.
So some things I learned today through the last week. I don't know, Jimmy, if you've had patients with nosebleeds, either in the ED on the floor. I remember when I was at BMC one time, we had like a staff assist for someone who just had like persistent refractory nosebleed. Have you come across that?
Yeah. I saw your tilt about this, which I know that you're about to go into, but one really interesting thing that one of the ED doctors once told me, and I don't know if you've heard this, is that have you ever heard of using cured pork to stop a nosebleed? So apparently there has been like a case report or a study done where ED doctors have used like cured pork, so essentially like bacon, to stop a nosebleed. The thought being that like cured pork has like these coagulation factors that actually help the coagulation and like and the cessation of epistaxis.
Do you eat it or do you topically apply it?
You topically apply it. You like literally stuff cured pork into the patient's nose. You know, obviously assuming that this patient is like not halal or like is otherwise okay with pork.
Do you think pharmacies stock cured pork? And what's stopping people from ordering it for themselves?
You know, I've never tried, but maybe next time I should try to look for cured pork order in Epic.
But the thing that I had always been taught, and what I remember from that case, was it's like pressure, afferent, ORL is kind of.
Oh yes, yeah. We should probably do this thing before going for the cured pork.
I think cured pork is after ORL. depending if they recommend it or not. Right. But I came across a study that was talking about TXA or transexamic acid, and it was this really interesting study. And it seems like I've never used this in residency, but it seems like it's much more common on the adult side and in the EDs, but that it's something that should be first line and that it has pretty much no harmful side effects. But there's some studies, and the one that I came across was a systematic review and meta-analysis of like thousands of patients that showed that has improved time to bleeding cessation and decreased risk of rebleeding without any increased adverse effects. And the way that you apply it is you find some kind of like topical gauze or pressure dressing, and you just put the TXA on that and then apply it.
So like the same formulation as you would use for like IV TXA?
I think so. Yeah. There's like dosing in the paper as well, but it's like the same way you would do like topical vasoconstrictors where you just apply it to a gauze and just put it in their nose.
Yeah. That's super cool. I've referred to a lot of your tilts this week, but I actually recently had a patient with hemophilia who had a frenulum tear and so kept bleeding. And they had been using aminocaproic acid or what's the brand name again?
Amicar.
Amicar to stop the bleeding, and it wasn't really working. And then I remember this tilt that you had tweeted, and I was like, why can we use TXA? Like, can we try topical TXA? And the attending ultimately said no, but because I think that both TXA and Amicar kind of it acts on the same part of the coagulation cascade, which is that both aminocaproic acid and TXA work to inactivate plasmin, which would have otherwise then gone on to stabilize the fibrin matrix. So by inactivating plasmin, you stabilize the coagulation. And so they just didn't think that like Amicar in addition to TXA would really add that much, but I definitely thought about it when I...
Maybe next time we should invite that hematology attending on, and me, a non-hematology resident, and that person, hematology attending, yes, can have a little bit of a debate on this paper that I only just recently found. Speaking of hemophilia, though, I saw that you had a tilt about kind of managing bleeding in these patients.
I did, yeah. So, I mean, same patient that I just mentioned, but we had a patient with hemophilia B, which is a deficiency in factor 9. So just to review, hemophilia A, which is slightly more common, is a deficiency in factor 8. I remember that because it's like A8. It's like, whereas... B9. I don't know. I actually didn't realize. So, I mean, I knew that these patients have a deficiency in those respective factors, but I actually didn't realize that a fraction of those with hemophilia can actually develop antibody inhibitors to that factor. So even if you were to try to replete their factor levels with that factor, so, you know, for this patient, if we had given them factor 9, their antibody inhibitors would actually just kind of inhibit the utility of that anyway. And so in these cases, what is done is that we usually give recombinant factor 7A, which essentially like bypasses the whole intrinsic coagulation cascade part and then activates the coagulation cascade via the extrinsic pathway to induce the coagulation cascade starting really from the common cascade. And I will be the first to admit that I literally just had to review the coagulation cascade right before we started recording because I can never remember all the different pieces of that cascade.
My other two tilts for this week were a little bit more random, but I've been cross-covering the MICU, and we have several patients with setups for pulmonary hypertension. And when I was on CARS, this was something that I saw not infrequently and something that was really terrifying, like how quickly patients can turn when they go into a pulmonary hypertensive crisis. So just thinking about if you're the first one in the room, what are the things that you can initially do to try to stabilize and resuscitate them? And pulmonary hypertension, the way I was looking into and thinking about it, is that it really presents in two ways. And it's either with profound hypoxemia, if their underlying like cardiac issue is that, or their pulmonary issues that they have some kind of mixing lesion, like a pop-off valve, or it's an atrial or a septal communication, or they present in like frank cardiac collapse, which is when they have no pop-off valve. And the reason being is if they go into a hypertensive crisis, if they have a way for the blood to get shunted from right to left, then they'll get deoxygenated blood and prevent hypoxemic. But if they have no shunt, then they're just going to have no cardiac output. But really the management is in three buckets. And the first bucket is the biggest one, which is just trying your best to reduce the pulmonary vascular resistance. So the first thing you do is just give 100% oxygen, thinking about like a non-rebreather, a simple face mask, whatever you have. And then if you need to bag the patient as well, doing that obviously sedating, calming them as much as possible. Crying just increases your PVR. And then things that you probably don't have immediate access to, but things that you're thinking about either in the cardiac ICU or in the other ICUs, is inhaled nitric oxide, but also just normalizing pH. So, you know, while you're doing the workup, acidosis leads to vasoconstriction in your pulmonary vasculature. So everything you can do to try to normalize that as well. Some of the other buckets, one of them is just, we talked about the cardiac collapse part of it. So augmenting preload and cardiac output. So again, being thoughtful for your use of fluids, you don't want to bolus them a huge amount, but you do want to make sure that they have enough to be able to push through. So maybe even a 10 per kilo bolus to start up, and then avoiding bradycardia as you can. And the final one is just good supportive care. So managing systemic hypotension just to maintain coronary artery flow. So whether you need vasoconstrictors as needed for that.
That seems like a fine balance that you'd hit, that you'd have to kind of strike between managing hypotension as well as decreasing PVR.
Yeah, I've seen one patient crash very quickly, and they ended up, it was like pretty much oxygen, 10 per kilo bolus, bag them, get them on high flow with inhaled nitric oxide, and then milrinone for a bit for its like PVR drop. And then they were quickly able to wean off of the milrinone and then just stayed on inhaled nitric until kind of the crisis resolved. But definitely something you need to act quickly on. And so I think just knowing your first step. And the last tilt that I had was just about pediatric IV placement. And something that I'd seen the IV team using more frequently is these J-tips. Have you seen J-tips? Yeah, and there is actually a study done that shows, one, it doesn't affect first pass success, so it doesn't harm you in any way, and actually decreases reported pain. One of the big benefits is like Emla and Letcream take a while to act, whereas a J-tip is instantaneous. So I think most nursing floors have them. So if you're ever placing an IV, I would reach for that first, probably.
Finally, just our resident highlights for the week. We just wanted to give a shout out to the Chiefs for organizing Funuary. It was so fun.
Nice pun. Did you come up with that one?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Did you go to any of the Funuary events, Fish?
I did. I got to go to one of the brunches with Kate Michelson was actually there. And it was just such a lovely experience until it started snowing on us, but still lovely to be around people.
Of course. And then a special shout out to Kylie for organizing BCRP Olympics, especially the t-shirt design. There are so many good entries. And a special congratulations to Ryan Brewster for coming up with the winning design, Bob's Famous Pasta, which will be a classic for years to come.
I can't wait for those shirts to come out and for everyone to be very confused who isn't part of this program. And we do want to give a shout out now that as we're moving into March, that this is National Women's History Month, and want to give a shout out to the OG, Elizabeth Blackwell, who is the first ever American woman to be awarded a medical degree. She's most well-known woman in medicine from that aspect. She used her ability to actually help train nurses during the Civil War and started an infirmary for underprivileged women and children in New York. And not only that, kind of set the scenes, it seems, for some global health work, where she made regular trips to all over Europe and has actually established the first British medical school for women in 1874, paving the way for other visionaries and wonderful people like her to pursue their ambition to become a doctor.
Well, this has been another episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lim.
And I'm Michael Fishman. Before we sign off, any upcoming events you want to let our audience know about?
No, nope, not this week.
Sounds exciting.
We want to thank Chris Cheston, our advisor, our future sponsors. Our theme music is Sweet Disposition by The Temper Trap, covered by our very own Michael Fishman. And our incidental music is The Four Open Notes of a Ukulele, played by yours truly.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in next week for our next episode of BCR Pod.